Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mordell, reading The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith, Chapter 20.
Those jewels puzzle me, Dick. What are they? Crane asked as the four assembled, waiting for first meal. He held up his third finger, upon which gleamed the royal jewel of Condal and its mounting of intensely blue transparent Aranac.
I know the name, Phaedon, but that is about all I seem to know.
Well, that's about all anybody knows. It occurs naturally, just as you see it there, deep blue apparently, but not actually transparent, constantly emitting that strong blue light. It cannot be worked, cut, ground, or even scratched. It will not burn or change in any arc Condalians can generate, and believe you me, that's saying a mouthful, it doesn't change in liquid helium. In other words, Mart, it seems to be inert.
How about acids?
I've been wondering about that, and fusion mixtures and such. Osnomians are pretty far back in chemistry. I'm going to get hold of another one and see if I can't break it down some way or other. I can't seem to convince myself that an atomic structure could be that big.
No, it would be a trifle oversized for an atom.
Crane turned to the two girls.
How do you like your solitaires?
They are perfectly beautiful, and this Tiffany mounting is exquisite, Dorothy replied enthusiastically. But they're so awfully big. They're as big as 10-carat diamonds, I do believe.
Just about, Seaton said, but at that they're the smallest Dunkirk could find. They've been kicking around for years, he says, so small nobody wanted them. They like big ones, you know. Wait till you get back to Washington, Dot. People will think you're wearing a bottle stopper until they see it shining in the dark. Then they'll think it's a misplaced tail light. But when the news gets out, whoa, jewelers will be bidding up $1 million per jump for rich old dames who want something nobody else can get, Chuck.
You are right, Dick, Crane said thoughtfully. Since we intend to wear them continuously. Jewelers will see them. Any jewel expert will know at a glance that they are new, unique, and fabulously valuable. In fact, they could get us into serious trouble, as fabulous jewels do.
Yeah, I never thought of that. Well, how about this? We'll let it out, casual-like, that they're as common as mud up here, and we're wearing them purely for sentiment. Well, that at least will be true. And we're going to bring in a shipload of them to sell for everlasting no-battery-needed automobile parking lamps. And if our girlfriends really do wear their gowns to the president's ball, as Dot says they're going to, well, that'll help too. Nobody would wear 38 pounds of cut stones on a dress if they cost very much each.
Well, that would probably keep anyone from murdering our wives for their rings, at least.
Have you read your marriage certificate, Dick? Margaret asked.
No, let's look at it, Dottie.
She produced the massive, heavily jeweled document, and the auburn head and the brown one were very close to each other as they read together the English side of the certificate. Their vows were there, word for word, with their own signatures beneath them, all deeply engraved into the metal. Seaton smiled as he saw the legal form engraved below the signatures and read aloud.
I, the head of the church and the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Condal upon the planet Osnome, certify that I have this day in the city of Condalec of said nation and planet joined in indissoluble bonds of matrimony Richard Ballinger Seaton, Doctor of Philosophy, and Dorothy Lee Vanneman, Doctor of Music, both of Washington, D.C., USA, upon the planet Earth in strict compliance with the marriage laws both of Condal and of the District of Columbia. Tarnan, Carbix of Condal,
witnesses, Roban, Emperor of Khandal, Tural, Empress of Khandal, Dunark, Crown Prince of Khandal, Sitar, Crown Princess of Khandal, Mark C. Duquesne, Washington, D.C., USA, Earth. That's some document, Seton said. How do you know it complies with the marriage laws of the district? I'm wondering if it does. Indissoluble in eternity. Mighty big words for American marriages. Do you think we better get married again when we get back? Both girls protested vigorously, and Crane said, No, I think not. I intend to register this just as it is and get a court ruling on it. It will undoubtedly prove legal. I'm not too sure about that, Seton argued. Is there any precedent in law that says a man can make a promise that will be binding on his immortal soul for all the rest of eternity? I rather doubt it. I'm sure there will be, however, when our attorneys close the case. You forget, Dick, that the Seton Crane Company Engineers has a very good legal staff. That's right. I bet they'll have fun kicking that one around. I wish that bell would ring.
So do I, Dorothy said. I just can't get used to not having any night, and
it's such a long time between meals, Seton put in, as the two famous governors said about the drinks.
How did you know what I was going to say?
Husbandly intuition, he grinned, aided and abetted by a stomach that is accustomed to only 6 hours between eats. After eating, the men hurried to the Skylark. During the sleeping period, the repellers had been banded on, and the guns and instruments, including a full Khandalian radio system, had been installed. Except for the power bars, she was ready to fly. The Khandalian vessel lacked both power bars and instruments. "How's the copper situation, Dunark?" Seton asked.
I don't know yet exactly. Crews are out scouring the city for all the metallic copper they can find, but they won't find very much. As you know, we don't use it, as platinum, indium, silver, and gold are so much better for ordinary use. We're working full-time on the copper plant, but it'll be a day or two or so yet before we can produce virgin copper. I'm going to work on our instruments and controls. If you two are temporarily at a loose end, you might help me.
Both men were glad to be of assistance. Crane was delighted at the chance to learn how to work that very hard and extremely stubborn metal, iridium, from which all the Khandalanian instruments were to be made. On the way to the instrument shop, Seton said to Crane, "But what tickles me most is this Aranac, not only for armor and so forth. I suppose you've noticed your razor.
How could I help it?
I can't understand how anything can be that hard, Mart. 40 years on an Aranac dust abrasive machine. Diamond dust won't touch it to hone it. And then it'll shave 10 men every day for 1,000 years and still have exactly the same edge it started with. That's what I would call a contribution to science."
Dunark's extraordinary skill and his even more extraordinary automatic machine tools made the manufacture of his instruments a comparatively short job. While it was going on, the foreman in charge of the scrap copper drive came in to report. Enough had been found to make 2 bars with a few pounds to spare. The bars were in the engines, one in each ship.
"Well done, Kolinix Melnin," Dunark said warmly. "I didn't expect nearly that much." "We got every last bit of metallic copper in the whole city," the foreman said proudly. "Fine," Seton applauded. "With 1 bar apiece, we're ready. Let 'em come."
"We don't want them to come here. We want to go there," Dunark said. "1 bar apiece isn't enough for that."
"That's right," Seton agreed. "For an invasion in force, no. I'd let you have ours, but 2 wouldn't be any better than 1. No, 4 at least, and I'm going to have 8. There should be some way of speeding up work on that copper plant, but I haven't been able to think of any."
speed it up. It's going at a fantastic speed already. On Earth, it takes months, not days, to build smelters and refineries.
I've got half a notion to go over there, but...
Bud is right, Seaton said. You'd be more apt to throw the boys off stride than anything else.
Could be, but... While the Kandalian prince was still standing undecided, a call for help came in. A freight plane was being pursued by a Carlon a few hundred miles away.
"Now's your time to study one, Dunark," Seaton exclaimed. "We'll drag him in here. Get your scientists out here."
The Skylark reached the monster before it reached the freighter. Seaton focused the attractor and threw on power, jerking the beast upward and backward. As it saw the puny size of the Skylark, it opened its cavernous mouth and rushed to attack. Seaton, not wishing to have his ship stripped of its repellers, turned them on. The monster was hurled backward to the point of equilibrium of the two forces, where it hung helpless, struggling frantically. Seaton towed the captive back to the field. By judicious pushing and pulling, and by using every attractor and repeller the Skylark mounted, the three Earthmen finally managed to hold that monstrous body flat on the ground. But not even with the help of Dunark's vessel could all of the terrible tentacles be pinned down. The scientists studied the creature as well as they could, from the battleships and from heavily armored tanks.
"I wish we could kill it without blowing it to bits," said Dunark via radio. "Do you know of any way of doing it?"
"No, except maybe poison. And since we don't know what would poison it and couldn't make it if we did, I don't see much chance. Maybe we can tire him out, though, and find out where he lives." After the scholars had learned all they could, Seaton yanked the animal a few miles into the air and shut off the forces holding it. There was a crash, and the Carlon, knowing that this apparently insignificant vessel was its master, shot away in headlong flight.
"What was that noise, Dick?" Crane asked.
"I don't know. New one on me.
Probably we cracked a few of his plates," Seaton replied as he drove the Skylark after the monster. Pitted for the first time in its life against an antagonist who could both outfly and outfight it, the Carlon put everything it had into its giant wings. It flew back over the city of Kondalek, over the outlying country, and out over the ocean as they neared the Mardonalian border. A fleet of warships came up to meet the monster. And Seaton, not wanting to let the enemy see the rejuvenated Skylark too closely, jerked the captive high into the air. It headed for the ocean in a perpendicular dive. Seaton focused an object compass upon it. "Go to it, sport," he said. "We'll follow you clear to the bottom if you want to go that far." There was a tremendous double splash as pursued and pursuer struck the water. Dorothy gasped, seized a handhold, and shut both eyes, but she could scarcely feel the shock. So tremendous was the strength of the Skylark's new hull, and so enormous the power that drove her. Seaton turned on his searchlights and closed in. Deeper and deeper the quarry dove. It became clear that the thing was just as much at home in the water as it was in the air. The lights revealed strange forms of life, among which were staring-eyed fishes, floundering blindly in the unaccustomed glare. As the Carlon bored still deeper, the living things became scarcer, but the Earthmen still saw from time to time the living nightmares that inhabited the oppressive depths of those strange seas. Continuing downward, the Carlon went clear to the bottom and stopped there, stirring up a murk of ooze. "How deep are we, Mart?"
"Something under 4 miles. No fine figures yet."
"Of course not. Strain gauges okay?"
"Scarcely moved off their zeros. Ha! Good news, even though I knew with my mind that they wouldn't. With our steel hull, they'd have been way up in the red. Wonderful stuff, this Aranac. Well, it looks as if he wants to sit it out here, and we won't find anything that way. Come on, sport, let's go somewhere else. Spaceship and Carlon went straight up, fast. On reaching the surface, the monster decided to grab altitude and went so high that Seton was amazed. I wouldn't have believed such a thing could possibly fly in air so thin, he exclaimed.
It is thin up here, Crane said. 4.16 pounds per square inch.
This is his ceiling, I guess. Wonder what he'll do next. As if in answer, the Carlon dived toward the lowlands of Condal, a swampy region lush with poisonous vegetation and inhabited only by venomous reptiles. As it approached the surface, Seton slowed the Skylark down, remarking, "He'll have to flatten out pretty quick or he'll bust something." But it did not flatten out. Diving all out, it struck the morass headfirst and disappeared. Astonished at such an unlooked-for development, Seton brought the Skylark to a halt and stabbed downward with the full power of the attractor. The first stab brought up nothing but a pillar of muck. The second, one wing and one arm. The third, the whole animal fighting as savagely as ever. Seton eased the attractor's grip. If he digs in here again, we'll follow him.
Will this ship stand it? Duquesne asked.
She'll stand anything, but you'd better all hang on. I don't know whether there'll be much of a jar or not.
There was scarcely any jar at all. After the Skylark had been pulling herself downward quite effortlessly for something over 1 minute, Seton glanced across at Crane, who was sitting still at his board doing nothing at all except smiling quietly to himself.
What are you grinning about, you Cheshire cat?
Just wondering what you came down here for and what you're going to prove. These instruments are lying unanimously and enthusiastically. Plastic flow, you know, not fluid.
Check. No lights, radar, or... Oh, we could build a sounder, though, or a velocimeter.
There are quite a few things we can do if you think it is worthwhile to take the time.
It isn't, of course. After a few minutes more, Seton again hauled the monster to the surface and into the air. Again, it attacked with unabated fury.
Well, that's about enough of that, I guess. Apparently, he isn't going home, unless his home was down there in the mud, which I can't quite believe. We can't waste much more time, so you might as well put him away.
The Mark V struck. The ground rocked and heaved under the concussion.
"Hey, I just thought of something," Seton exclaimed. "Well, we could have taken him out and set him into an orbit around the planet. And without air, water, or food, he'd die sometime, I think. Then they'd have a perfect specimen to study."
"Why, Dick, what a horrible idea!" Dorothy's eyes flashed as she turned on him. "You wouldn't want even such a monster as that to die that way."
Nah, I guess I wouldn't really. He's a game fighter, so we'll let Dunark do it sometime if he wants to.
The Skylark reached the palace dock just before fourth meal, and while they were all eating, Dunark told Seton that the copper plant would be in production in a few hours and that the first finished bar would roll at 0.34, in other words, immediately after first meal of the following day.
"Fine," Seton exclaimed. "You'll be ready in the Condal. Take the first 8 bars and be on your way." And there goes Martindale.
"Impossible, as you already know, if you think a little."
"Oh, I see the code. Well, I wouldn't want you to break it, of course, but it couldn't be stretched just enough to cover a situation like this, which has never come up before."
"It cannot," Dunark said stiffly.
"But suppose, pardon me, Dunark, ignorance. I never really scanned it before. You're right. I'll play ball."
"What's the matter, Dick?"
Dorothy whispered into his ear. Oh, what did you do to him? I thought he was going to blow his top.
I said something I should have known better than to say. He replied loudly enough so that Dunark too could hear. Also, I shouldn't have told you the schedule I had in mind. It's been changed. The Skylark gets her copper first, then the Condal, and Dunark doesn't leave until we do. Why, I don't know any more than Dunark can figure out with all he got from my mind why you and I insist on wearing clothes. It's a matter of code.
But just that little extra time wouldn't make any difference, would it?
One chance in a million, maybe, with the bars rolling off the line so fast. No, after all this time, half an hour more won't make any difference. I suppose your men are loading the platinum, Dunark.
Yes, they're filling number 3 storeroom full.
Good work, Seaton, Duquesne said. I've often wished there was some way of getting platinum out of jewelry and into laboratories and production, and your scheme will do it. I don't think much of your judgment in passing up the chance to make $1 million or so, but I'll be glad to see jewelers drop platinum. I wonder how they'll put it across that platinum isn't the thing for jewelry anymore.
Oh, they can keep on using it all they want of it, Seaton said innocently, at exactly the same price as stainless steel.
Who do you think you're kidding? Duquesne's reply was not a question, but a sneer. On the following morning, immediately after breakfast, enough bars were ready to supply both vessels. The Skylark was fueled first, then the Condal. Both ships hopped across plain and city, and, timed to the split second, landed as one upon the palace dock. Both crews disembarked and stood at half attention, the 3 Americans dressed in their whites, the 20 Condalian high officers wearing their robes of state.
This stuff is for the birds. Seaton's lips scarcely moved, only Crane could hear him. We stand here for exactly so many seconds to give the natives a treat. His eyes flicked upward as the aircraft filled the air. Then we come to full attention as the Grand Moguls and the High Panjandrums appear escorting our wives and the battleship salute, and blast such flummery.
But think of how the girls are enjoying it, Crane said, using Seaton's own technique, and you're going to do it, so why gripe about it?
I'd like to do more than pop off. I'd like to call Dot and tell her to shake a leg, but I won't. With Dunark what he is, I have to play ball, but I don't have to like it.
Please join me next time for another exciting chapter of The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith, here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Until then, watch the skies. Thank you.